This is not my first time at MIT. I was here just 30 years ago, 1988, and I spoke to the MIT Artificial Intelligence Group. So those of you who remember Digital Equipment Corporation, I was the general manager of the Artificial Intelligence Business Group. We did about $200 million of sales back then, and we were partners with MIT and with Carnegie Mellon as well. In developing not only research on AI, but applying it on expert systems. So we have some sort of a relationship that goes back a little ways. I will call your attention. I do have one note card, because I don't want to mess this up, that on the ASA website, if you would visit that, there is a call for papers on artificial intelligence. And the article is written by Dr. Derek Sherman. The article's name or title is Discerning a Christian Response to Artificial Intelligence. It's a terrific article. It's a long article. It's easy to read. I think you'll really enjoy going on the website and taking a look at that. I would also call your attention to that the MIT Media Lab and Harvard have partnered up on a $27 million grant to determine what the artificial intelligence impact will be on ethics. So I'll call your attention to that article. I think you'll really enjoy it. There was just my last talk that I gave, actually the last class that I gave at Florida Gulf Coast. The first class I gave, this lady stood up in the front and she said, "You know, Mr. Flagg, in full disclosure, I want you to know that I am a professional astrologer." And what is that? I'm not sure what that means. We are going to talk about cosmetology, if that's of interest. But that's we really have some very, very strange questions that come up at times. The reason I chose this photo of the Eagle Nebula, the Pillars of Creation, is because it has a nice analogy to my book, and I named the pillars Faith, Science, and Reason. And the analogy is that this is a star nursery. It is constantly creating new stars. Already 8,000 stars have been born and formed in that nebula. Probably another 8,000 will be formed before it ultimately dies out. But it's a constantly changing, evolving, life-giving nebula. And that's how I see my cosmology model. And it is an ongoing, real life. If you read the paper today, you're going to pick up something that's going to change the model. There's so many discoveries, and there's so much more insight coming from theology and coming from philosophy, as well as discovery from science, that it's a model that constantly is looking for new insights. So let's... Many of you are familiar with the term cosmology. And what is that? It's the scientific study of the universe from its beginning to present day and ultimately to its end. Some might call that the scientific study of cosmogony, the beginning, present day, which would be the cosmic and biological evolution, and then to its ultimate end, which would be called eschatology. So that's typically when someone says cosmology, how you interpret that. In holistic cosmology, is quite different. So I want to go through this real slow. It's a comprehensive study of the universe through a tri-lens of faith, science, and reason. Holistic cosmology is really a methodology or a framework for applying the body of knowledge that you get from the tri-lens, for applying that body of knowledge as it pertains to the meaning and to the relevance of the universe and its many cosmic mysteries. So it's a little bit different, quite a bit different than just the typical standard cosmology. So the framework sort of looks like this, sort of copied from Plato's framework on knowledge. But there we go. Oh, it doesn't come up on the screen. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Okay, another little gremlin. But
a cosmic mystery.
Yeah. But so the three areas: faith and religion, based on scripture and beliefs; reason and philosophy, based on logic and even imagination; and then the science and nature based on laws and experience. So that's sort of the framework. So there's a lot of ideologies, a lot of principles, a lot of theories that go into these three areas or perspectives. And out of that, I'm trying to learn what that means to some of the cosmic mysteries. So holistic, a new worldview, what does that mean? Well, holistic is the whole is greater than its parts. And religion is about systematic theology. You might think that systematic theology is looking at a topic thoroughly throughout the Bible, not just reading the Bible page 1 through page 500, but looking at something like creation. We tend to think of creation as Genesis 1. Well, there are 57 verses in the Bible on creation. So if you really want to understand what does creation mean theologically, you would want to pull out all 57 of those, a systematic way of looking at and analyzing the Bible. In science, it's about a composite image. What do I mean by a composite image? Well, an astronomer quite often will look at, through their telescope, through the optical or the visible light version of an object. Let's call that a galaxy. And they will get a picture, an image, and be able to interpret from that image what the attributes are of that galaxy. But what if you looked at that same image through a radio wave telescope, through an infrared telescope, through an ultraviolet telescope, through an X-ray telescope, and through a gamma ray telescope? You are going to get an unbelievable amount of insight and information that you never would have gotten if you just had looked at the one optical or visible light. So it's a very different way of looking at it. Philosophy, inclusiveness, worldview is the philosophy of life. And religion is about religious pluralism, the John Locke version, if you will, the philosopher John Locke, religious pluralism. Everyone is invited to the table. Every idea is invited to the table. And science is about convergence of evidence. For example, in evolution, all sciences converge and conclude to the same end result. And philosophy is about big history. Many of you heard about big history? It's a whole new way of teaching history that started in Australia and has now moved into the United States. It's being taught in high schools and some colleges. But big history is not just looking at, well, what's the history from the Industrial Revolution or the history from the Civil War. It's looking at history comprehensively, going back 14 billion years, and including not just the typical revolutionary kinds of things that you get out of history, but the nature, what happened in nature, what were the cultural changes, what were the theological changes and political changes, looking at it very holistically. We're going to use, or I'm going to use, five different mysteries. There's about 20 or 24 or so that I use in the book. But we're going to look at these four or five to get some insight as to how the model is applied to the cosmic mysteries. What are they? Who or what is at the center of the universe? I bet you if we polled here, we'd get a lot of different kinds of answers. Who or what is at the center of our universe? You can personalize that. How will it all end? Not a good question. How will it all end for me? Our species? Earth, sun, and even the universe. What is time? You know, Aristotle was asked about, which is, he's just an incredible philosopher, theologian, scientist, but he was asked, Mr. Aristotle, what is time? He said, I know exactly what time is. Just don't ask me to explain it. And time is just that way. And is time an illusion? What did Einstein say? Time is an illusion. He kind of thought of it this way. Part of it was because of his bias, religious bias, or non-religious bias, I should say. But he said, well, if the universe is eternal, then there was no beginning, there was no end. So if there's no beginning and no end, there could be no middle, no present. So time is just an illusion. Different way of looking at it. Are we alone? There are so many articles and magazine and books. Leslie does a great job in her book, Out of the Big Bang, and talking about are we alone in the universe? And I've kind of taken a little bit different approach to it. I'm going to talk about are we alone, but I'm going to assume that we're not and say contact. We're going to make contact. Now what? Now what do we do? Will we make the decision, or will they make the decision? And what is a miracle? Are they real or misunderstood? And science alone cannot answer these questions. Excuse me. Going back about 4,000 years, there's been a lot of paradigm shifts throughout history. And one of the questions I thought I'd do in my research, does a paradigm shift cause a new cosmology model, or does a new cosmology model cause a paradigm shift? Is there synergy between the two? Is there a relationship? And there certainly is. We've gone over the last 4,000 years from mythology to theology, from geo to helo, from creationism to evolution, from determinism to probability, Aristotle to Newton, classical physics from Newton to general and special relativity, from the Reformation and the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment, all happening at the same time in our history, from atheism to humanism. Don't get me going on that one. I will get going a little bit, but I can't. And from a universe to a multiverse, and from the theory of nothing, remember Genesis 1, built out of nothing. When we mean by nothing, that is the absence of anything, the absence of anything, to the theory of everything. So what are the cosmology models that were affected by this? Well, we can go back to 2000 BC, and the first ones to introduce a cosmology model were the Hindus, the cosmic egg, the Brahmanda oscillating universe. Interestingly enough, this has been revisited by astrophysicists and theologians and philosophers throughout history. And I'm not going to go through each one of those. I just want to give you an idea. Is the P and the T is philosophy, T is theology, and S is science. So way back in that period of time, it was mostly philosophy and theology where the models were coming from. The Genesis creation, the first and final cause from Aristotle, and so forth. And then from 1500 to 1800, we had one heck of a thing going on. We had all three of these things going on simultaneously. The scientific revolution, the heliocentric universe, that is, was a big deal because before that it was geocentric. It was the Earth was the center of the universe, right? Now it's the sun is the center of the universe. And boy, were there arguments, debates. Even somebody got thrown in jail for 400 years. Remember who that was? Galileo. In the Protestant Reformation and the impact that Calvin and that Luther made on not only the theology, but the enormous amount of conflict that existed between Copernicus and with Martin Luther and Calvin on this whole idea of geocentric versus heliocentric, because this was heresy to be talking against the biblical translation of what was the center of the universe. And then the Age of Reason. In the last couple hundred years, it's been dominated by science, as you might expect. Einstein's static universe, Big Bang from Father Lemaitre, the steady state, inflation by Guth, cold dark matter with a little bit of dark energy thrown in, the anthropic model, Carter, Barrow, and Tipler, many, many, many different models that cosmology models, about 24 of them on this page. If you look at it in total, it gets very busy. It's this body of knowledge that I used, that I extracted from these thought leaders to try to build my model to answer these cosmic questions. A lot of different models of great thinkers throughout history. The theory of everything, according to science and a little bit of philosophy. Because if you're a scientist, you're automatically a philosopher. If you're a theologian, you're automatically a philosopher. We've got about 22 philosophers in this room, right? We all have our ideas, our philosophy of life. Theory of everything, which is the integration or the collection of the standard model of particle physics in agreement with the general relativity, combining the three forces of subatomic forces with gravity, which has been a real challenge for many, 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 many different scientists, thousands of scientists working on this theory of everything. Well, this self-proclaimed atheist, Lee Smolin, put it this way. Theory of everything will also have wide repercussions and likely bring about or contribute to a shift to our understanding of ourselves and our relationships to the rest of the universe. Doesn't sound like he's that much of an atheist to me. He may have claimed to be, but so many of these atheists at certain points in time, even Sagan and even Hawking and so many of them revert back to a supreme being that really, or a supreme divinity of some sorts that had something to do with the creation of this universe. But my favorite writer, I think you would like this writer too, John Polkinghorne. John Polkinghorne won the Templeton Award, which is the Faith Science Award. He is a theologian. He is an ordained priest. He is a science physical a physicist. He is a philosopher. He writes terrific, terrific material. He made this statement: the universe is intelligible. Science is privileged to investigate a universe that is both rationally transparent and rationally beautiful. Isn't that nice? I actually believe that the greatest unified theory of everything is provided by the belief in God. That is so powerful. That is just so powerful. So let's look at the first mystery. Well, before I look at the first mystery, I want to talk a little bit about epistemology. That's easy to say, isn't it? Epistemology. There's epistemology of philosophy, epistemology of science, and there's epistemology of theology. But what it is what is knowledge? How do you know that you have knowledge? Well, very easy. In faith, it's pretty simple. I know by faith and scripture alone. Sola fide, sola scriptura. And reason, how do I know what I know? And in science, the more I know, the more I know I don't know. We're just never satisfied as scientists, are we? We weren't satisfied. Einstein wasn't satisfied with Newton. Hawking wasn't satisfied. Now with Einstein, and it goes on and on and on. We never know enough. So the first mystery, who or what is at the center of the universe? In faith, as I mentioned, it's about sola fide and sola scriptura, which is by faith and by scripture alone. I'm going to go into these in a little bit of detail. Faith, one of the things is singularity. Well, there's singularity in the Trinity, Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. There's systematic theology, which is Karl Barth's Church Dogmatics, where the center of the universe is God. And then there's the Apostles' Creed, among many other creeds, where the Trinity is the center of the universe. In science, singularity is about the Big Bang singularity. It's about stellar black hole singularity, supermassive black hole singularity, a non-dimensional point that holds all the energy of that particular object that imploded into a singularity. And then the laws. Earth was the center of the universe. Then it became the sun was the center of the universe. And this went back and forth for quite some time. But the law was, especially theologically, that the sun was the center of the universe. And then we got telescopes out there and said, oh my goodness, what is this stuff here out here? The galaxy, our galaxy is the center of the universe. You know what the center of the universe is now? Nothing. Center. Every point in the universe is the center of the universe. And no point is the center of the universe. So science sees the center of the universe very differently. In philosophy, anthropically, and I'll talk about that more, anthropically, the center of the universe is mankind. The universe was compelled to evolve intelligence and sapient life. It had no choice. The universe had no choice, anthropically, philosophically. And singularity, the concern that AI, artificial intelligence, manifests not in mankind, but in inorganic bodies, androids. And that's a little bit about what this article is, and the ASA article, and what MIT and Harvard have combined to study. What are the ethics? What are the concerns that we must have? Because we're moving away from mankind. We're moving into this artificial intelligent world. And then singularity, or excuse me, humanism. What is humanism? It's all about me. It's all about me. I had the pleasure last year of speaking at the Chautauqua Institute. And after the talk, we went over to the amphitheater because there was a talk going on humanism. And a fellow by the name of Greg Epstein was the feature speaker. A couple thousand people. I had 90 in my group. He had 2,000 in his. Should have been the first. And he talked about humanism. He is the chaplain of humanism at Harvard University. Doesn't that seem like an oxymoron to you? The chaplain? The chaplain of humanism? My goodness sake. Pardon me? Yeah. And within the Ivy League, there are four chaplains of humanism within the Ivy League, 200 nationally. Very, very concerned. So, what do these folks have to say? Martin Luther, John Locke, and Copernicus. Well, with Martin Luther, the center of the universe was the church, theocracy. And that was, in his 95 posting, he made it very, very clear that the theocracy is not the center, but that Jesus Christ is the center of the universe. Going back to Paul's writings, very, very clear. In Copernicus, he said, no, the earth is not the center of the universe. The sun is the center of the universe. Well, these two folks argued. They were contemporaries. These two folks, matter of fact, Calvin and Martin Luther called Copernicus a heretic. A heretic. And then, of course, John Locke, who was all about self, is the center of the universe. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And he's the originator of liberalism and republicanism. Made major contributions, obviously, to the way we see government. Galileo was asked to explain his views on biblical truths.
Yeah.
I think in the first place that it is very pious to say and prudent to affirm that the Holy Bible can never speak the untruth as long as it is properly understood. Wow. There are 40 English translations of the Bible in circulation in the United States today. 40 different ones. All with a little bit of spin differently, all looking for it, targeting a different audience, all looking for to give clarity to the Bible. Einstein was asked whether science and religion conflict. Not really, though it depends, of course, on your religious views. Seeing that he's not praying, he's meditating. C.S. Lewis, who's one of my favorite writers, just an outstanding writer in all kinds of, probably the apologist of the 20th century, would you say? Mm-hmm. The apologist of the 20th century. He makes this statement, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. Now, holistically, I'm going to look at this a little different. I'm going to change one letter. I'm going to change the U in sun. I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see him, but because by him I see everything else. This is a different way, a different approach, holistically, thinking about theology and thinking about science and thinking about philosophy. I think it's so powerful. Dr. Joel Primack and his wife Nancy Abrams wrote a couple of books. One book was The View from the Center of the Universe. And this is really cool stuff. It's a great book. Have you read it? It's a terrific book. It's been out for a while. And he called it the Cosmic Ouroboros. The Ouroboros is a snake that actually swallows its own tail. And the science behind this is, well, the smallest object in the world is the Planck constant. 10 to the minus 35th centimeters. That is really, really, really small. The largest object in the universe, or structure in the universe, is a galaxy cluster, a supercluster, all structure that is all related to each other, all gravitationally related to each other. That is 10 to the 30 centimeters. So there are 60 orders of magnitude in the structure of the universe. Guess which object is at the center structurally? We are. We are right in the middle. If we were one order of magnitude less or greater, we wouldn't have intelligence. although some would argue that we never found intelligence. Anyway, but he makes a great point in this book that we are really special. We're very, very special. In the structure of the universe, there's only one structure that has intelligence. Here's a statement that he makes, and we'll read through this slowly. We might do better to think of the beginnings as being just as unknown as the distant future, and ourselves as true explorers moving outward from the center in both directions. In cosmology, both the distant past and the distant future are in a real sense ahead of us, the one waiting to be discovered and the other to be created. Center of the universe. Mystery two, the end and the end of times. We could do it, do a same application of the model on the beginning or on the present. In this case, I'm just doing it on the end. In faith, the end, the faith, or in the biblical interpretation of the end, it's either us or it's the world, the end of times. And reason is, why is there an end? Is there an afterlife? How will we know if there's an afterlife? And in science, there's an end to us, an end to our species, an end to the earth, an end to the sun, an end to the universe. Let's look at faith. It's pretty simple in faith. John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have what? Eternal life. In Revelations, I am the Alpha, the beginning, and the Omega, the end. And that says the Lord God, who is, and who was, and who is yet to come. So very, very clear. The rest of Revelations is not quite as clear to me, but that one is. But that statement is. In science, the end of times is about, for us, it's natural causes. For you and me, it's a natural cause. For our species, it's their extinction events or stupidity. Stupidity is really getting a lot of play these days. You write a lot about that, Leslie. You really do. You're doing the Arctic study now. She talks a lot about that and the God of the Big Bang. But the extinction events, there have been five major extinction events in the last 500 million years. That's one every 100 million years. Sounds like a long time, but in cosmic time, that's not very long. Five extinctions. In each case, the dominant species went extinct. In each case, all natural extinction events, either asteroids or caldera, major explosions or pandemics, all kinds of things that cause extinction events. With the Earth will end through the sun's expansion. We will be cinderized by the sun at some point, probably a couple billion years. But if you want to talk about climate change in about a billion years from now, you better have a place to go. Or we have to become gophers. The sun will ultimately enlarge to a super red giant, and then it will turn into a white dwarf, and ultimately into a black dwarf. The universe, the big rip or the big freeze. The universe will continue to grow, and dark energy will ultimately take over. And it will just rip the universe apart ultimately. These are theoretical now. These are not giving you facts. You don't have to go home and be concerned about the big rip. Because if it happens, it's going to happen that quick and it doesn't matter. Or the big freeze that ultimately we run out of energy. All the energy is expended. So all events stop. And when events stop, what also stops? Time. Time stops. Then you have another application. You could have the big crunch or the big bounce. The big crunch would be the universe continues to expand, ultimately slows down, and then it starts to come back an hour by hour by hour, all the way back to either the big crunch or the big bounce, the oscillating universe. And one of the things that I thought about 3 o'clock in the morning, which is a great time to think, but if the universe starts to implode back to its original time, does time continue to move forward? Well, it does, but it's moving in reverse, isn't it? And if it's moving in reverse, do we live our lives over again, but in reverse? Ooh, that's a scary thought. These are some of the things that you could think about at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're into this kind of stuff. What are the reasons for the end of time? Well, teleology, the end is there is a purpose rather than a cause. Aristotle writes a lot about this. Thomas Aquinas writes a lot about this. You know, the four causes. That there is a purpose for an end. In dualism, philosophical dualism, without dualism, there is no soul, no God. The body exists independent from the soul. And that's an article, a recent article, written by Warner Wallace, who's a terrific author. Cold Case Christianity is his. Would you call it a blogger? Would you call it a, yeah, more of a blog? And he writes a very, very good article on the brief argument for the existence of the soul. Really interesting article. Then there's eschatology verification. Easy for you to say. Now let's read this slowly because this is kind of tricky. EV is the process whereby a proposition such as, is there an afterlife? If true, you have verifiable truth. Epistemology. But if it's false, it's not falsifiable as the individual will not know it's false because they have no state of being. Ontological. So a very philosophical way of looking at the end or the end of times. Mystery 3. Time travel is easy. It's only a technology problem. That's a pretty good show, isn't it? Big Bang Theory. Time travel is easy. It's just a technology problem. Well, again, we could go into all kinds of different applications of the model. We could talk about time's direction, before and after time. What is now simultaneity and time travel, which we'll take a quick look at. In faith, you have young earth creationism and you have old earth creation. So what is time? Big difference between 7,000 years and 14 billion years in terms of what is the interval of time. Then you have God's time, which is eternal time. He is outside of time and space. He's outside of time and space. Lizzie makes a good point in her book Out of the Big Bang on the programmer who writes the program for the universe. Well, you don't write a program from inside the program, do you? You write the program outside the program, and you might even put some corrections in there. There'll be automatic corrections that will if things are going off course, they'll automatically correct themselves. Isn't that what God did? And in reason, you have presentism. Presentism is really, really simple. Presentism philosophically is only the present exists. So what existed just 2 moments ago, no longer, those objects are gone. Future objects that didn't exist have moved into this room and now the present, but only the present exists. In growing block theory, says, well, no, the past continues to exist, and we add to the present by the future creating new objects or creating enhancing objects. Eternalism is really the good one. The past, present, and future all exist simultaneously. All exist simultaneously. Now, some theological concerns about that, you know, fatalism as an example. You know, if the past, present, and future all exist, then and we don't have a whole lot of choice, but he gave us choice, didn't he? Mm-hmm. He gave us. And science, time travel, time dilation, you know, the Einstein's special general relativity. You know, the time is a function of gravity and it's a function of speed. So depending upon a very massive object and a very high speed, you can actually move through time. Then you have quantum time, which is no time. You have entanglement, which is simultaneous time. So science gives you many different versions of how you view time before you start to answer the question of time travel. Well, here are a couple of comments that I concluded. Traveling back in time is only a technology problem. Well, it's a big, big problem. Theoretically, you have to create what's called a wormhole. You see them on TVs and, you know, all these movies where they fall through a wormhole. foot would take 1/10 of the stars of the Milky Way's energy. 1/10 for a year to create a wormhole that you could walk through to get into a different dimension or a different time or a different place. So it's more than just a technology problem. If you do go backward, or in the past, can't be changed anyway, so why bother? You're just going to go as a tourist? If you do go backward or forward, who builds the receiving machine on the other side? Nobody there. Can I get back to where and when I left? I don't think so. Traveling forward in time, theoretically, yes, if you can travel at the speed of light. But what about to return? What are we to return to? What if that's already gone? And when do I return? Hawking gave out an invite shortly before he died to see if there really were time travels. And he posted all over the place, on the internet and on buildings. He was going to have a meeting. The meeting was to be held 3 days in the past. So nobody currently could come. They already missed it, right? The only people that come were time travelers. He was all alone. Time travel is also conditioned on whether eternalism is real. That is, that the past, present, and future exist simultaneously, that objects coexist. So even if you were to be able to travel scientifically, if eternalism isn't true, then where are you going to go to? But philosophy allows your imagination to travel through time without the limitations of technology. So what is time? Before the beginning? Well, time at creation. Time wasn't around before time. Something may have been around, but it wasn't time. I don't know who that, I wish I knew who that quote came from, but I've lost it. And into the future. Yesterday, I moved into the future, and here I am. John Carroll. Mystery 4. Are we alone? I know this is one of Leslie's favorite topics. And if the answer is no, and there's contact, now what? According to faith, divine creation, yes or no? We don't know whether God had the intention of creating more than us. What was and is his plan? Omnipotence, well, yes or no? It's God's will. We really don't know. Our free will cannot answer that question. Deism and determinism, no, we are not alone. We are not alone because his laws are pervasive. They're pervasive across 100 billion light years of the universe. It's pervasive. The same laws that exist here exist in the next star system, exist in the next galaxy. And Homo Divinus, the complete human, the God-given soul that he gave to us. So yes, we are alone. We are really, really special. The only species with a soul that can experience God. Experience God. Special little note here, NASA just granted $1 million to the Center of Theological Inquiry on the topic of religious implications of extraterrestrial life. Isn't that interesting? To foster theology's dialogue with astrobiology on its societal implications. So there's somebody there in NASA saying, let's think about this a little bit. Is there going to be an impact on religion if contact is made? And reason, or philosophy. The cosmological year for us, which I talked about, and the Copernicus complex, which is, we are alone. We are alone, we are special indeed. Life, not so much, perhaps. But intelligent, conscious, cognitive, communicative life, with a soul, is special. What it takes to get from an amoeba, one cell, to a conscious, cognitive, communicative, soul-based human is an incredible trip. Paine's Age of Reason, philosophical deism. No, we are not alone. Nature will run its course. No divine intervention. Reason replaces revelation. That's the takeaway. And philosophical deism. Reason replaces revelation. Doesn't it just make sense that the other civilizations exist? It's sort of the Occam's razor approach, the simplest solution is probably the correct one. And then anthropic reasoning, and I'll take responsibility for this. No, we are not alone. The universe is what it is because as observers, we experience it. If we were not here, by definition, the universe would not have had the natural laws as we know them. Therefore, the universe could not exist either. In science, the whole thought about mediocrity, we are just one star out of billions and trillions and trillions of stars, that we are just average. We're just mediocre. We're just mediocre. The Drake equation, the Francis Drake equation, which is a algorithmic way of trying to determine what the possibility is of other civilizations existing. And every single scientist, I've worked with equations with different assumptions, and you'll come up with pretty strange numbers. But every time there's a new assumption, or every time there's a new discovery, the equation gets changed, and a new number comes out. Adam Frank, professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester, made this recent prediction. He estimates that there are 10 to the 22, that's a lot of zeros, habitable Earths in the universe, offset by 10 to the minus third, or maybe 10 to the minus 30, or maybe 10 to the minus 50, who knows? But you have this equation going on. What are they? You have this law of numbers on one side. It says, whoa, but you got all these habitable Earths, and then you got this law of numbers on the other side, which says, but we are so special, we are so rare indeed. He said, because what it takes to get the inorganic material to life has never been understood. Only God understands that. Evolution takes billions of years. Life to intelligent life is a major leap. And extinction events, even though you may have evolved life, extinction events, whether they're natural or otherwise, tend to. These are all real, real clear issues in the Drake equation. He concluded this, is we have no idea what the number is, except we know it's at least one. Right? We know it's at least one. A rare deep universe indeed, 10 to the 200, the Fermi paradox. Well, yes, we are alone. Where are they? If they're all out there, why haven't they appeared to us? Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. There's a search going on. SETI, METI. You probably haven't heard. You've all heard of SETI, Carl Sagan and all that group. Listing for signals from outer space, from interstellar space. METI is messaging to extraterrestrials. That is a whole new development where we are sending out messages to space looking for ET to intercept that message and say, hey, we got somebody out there. Right? They have the same instrumentation, probably a lot greater technology than we have. But Hawking was very, very against that. He said, hey, you don't know what you're going to find. You just don't know. And then, of course, you have exoplanets. We're now up to about 4,000 exoplanets. And that's going to go up exponentially with all the new telescopes. Telescopes to the X power. We'll take a quick look at that in a minute. So, no, we are not alone. There's just no question. We're putting all of these billions and billions of dollars in research on the assumption that they're out there. And then, of course, we have the UFOs and the close encounters of the third kind. So, according to the... You heard of the Loop Project, the old project where they studied 12,000 different UFO sightings, and they gated nearly every single one. But there was a handful. They just can't figure that out. There are all kinds of authentic, credible people who have said, hey, we've talked to them. We've been there. We've been on their ship. My sister was in one. Are you kidding me? So contact. Now what? Why would ET make contact? Are we still special? more questions, honestly, than answers. The protocol, if we do make contact, if let's just say that the United States makes contact in some way, they go through a whole series of protocols with at least 14 other countries and other scientific organizations before any one of those is allowed to make any announcement. So there's a very stringent process, protocol in place, that if contact is made, they will follow this procedure before scaring the hell out of everybody. And what happens to national sovereignty? Will there be borders? That famous picture of the blue planet. There's no borders on the blue planet, are there? Are we safe? What is ET's motivation and agenda? In science, well, they're going to be really happy about this. They're going to get a transfer of technology, medicine, space travel, physics, chemistry. All this technology transfer that would happen if we made contact with an advanced civilization. Are there other civilizations? Where are they? What is their biology? What is their home planet environment? Philosophy. What is ET's appearance and compatibility with our species? Can we live together? Well, you watch all the TV science programs. It doesn't appear that there's ever been one that can live together, is there? Theology. What about sin? What about sin? Do they know Jesus? What is ET's theology? Are we still special? Ted Peters, Professor Emeritus at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary, put it this way. We are as special to God as all our children are special to us. Think about that. Every one of our children is special to us. Religions are expecting ET. I put New Atheism down as a religion because they claim that they're a religion. 55% believe that we will find ET. Muslims, 44%. Jews, 37%. General Christian denominations, 32 to 37%. Baptists, 29%. Evangelicals and young earth creationists approaching zero. You have a question?
I'm just curious about that.
It's a recent study that was just issued. I don't know how credible the study was, but it's some of the recent statistics. Contact. Now what? Who will represent Earth? Trump. I'm going to build a dome. And they're going to pay for it. Sigourney Weaver, boy, she's been up close, and she actually became one, didn't she, in Alien 4 or something? William Shatner, Captain Kirk, oh my goodness, he'd make so many of them, he'd be a great... How about Jodie Foster, Contact, my favorite movie of all time? I'm listening. And Neil deGrasse, the marketeer, the best. But if I were going to choose for someone, it would be someone... that understands science. Someone that understands theology. Someone that understands humanness. Not humanism. Humanness.
Yes. Woohoo! That's not me!
And those are real credentials. So when contact is made, I think we have your endorsement, right?
Yes.
Oh my God, I didn't see that coming.
What about the miracle of creation? You can't have a talk on faith and science and not talk about creation. One, faith is about divine special revelation, that is, intervention by God Himself, the incarnation. The resurrection. Special revelation. In science, it's divine general revelation. In other words, God reveals Himself through science and through discovery. And in reason, it's about the law of impossibilities. There is no such thing as a miracle. It all can be explained. Hawking said, creation from nothing. Hawking, Moses, Lewis, and Aquinas all agree. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing, why the universe exists and why we exist. Moses said, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty, out of nothing, out of not of anything. C.S. Lewis, I love this one. There was never a time when nothing existed, otherwise nothing would exist. But now I believe that no longer. And Thomas Aquinas, all effects are the result of cause, going back to the beginning of time, where there must be a creator who exists outside of time and space. So what's the answer? The answer is, we were talking about this before, it just doesn't matter. God did it. By far, the greatest miracle ever is the universe itself. Very good chapter in the book of Europe. God did. You got new telescopes and colliders coming on, and this is just a handful out of 15-20 that will be up and running over the next 10 years. The James Webb will be going up in 2020. The ELMA replaces Arecibo. They have 66 39-foot antennas networked together. The LSST, isn't that a beautiful machine they got there? The LSST. New gravity wave telescope, that's really instruments, new gravity wave, that allow us to look past science, look past the cosmic microwave background, to look all the way through time, and tests looking for new exoplanets. And the LHC, twice the energy level of the Large Hadron Collider that found the God particle. You know, the God particle was founded by Higgs boson, who's an atheist, which is kind of interesting. And when the Higgs boson was named, it wasn't named the God particle, it was named the Goddamn particle. And Higgs was not very happy that they named it the God particle, being an atheist. Within the next decade, we'll be able to see or witness the beginning of time and space, maybe creation. When observing the stars, you say, oh my, I do. Or when experiencing the heavens, you say, oh my God, haven't you ever experienced that? You say, wow, it's an awe of creation. When you look at the Cone Nebula, do you see this nebula, or do you experience it? Acts 7:41, heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. What kind of house will you build for me? Where will my resting place be? Has not my hand made all these things? It's called the hand of God. The Eagle Nebula, M16, great image, super image. But can't you experience it? Through Psalm 33, for the word of God is right and true. He is faithful in all he does. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, the starry host by the breath of his mouth. My conclusion in holistic cosmology is God will reveal his theory of everything, one miracle at a time. Amen.
I think we have a little time for questions. I'm not sure how late you guys normally go, but we have how much time?
We have this till 9.
Okay. So are there questions for Scott? Everybody's just stunned in the silence.
Yeah. Did you agree? Are we alone? Show of hands, are we alone yet? Right. Yes, we are alone. Yes, we are alone. No, we are not alone. You know, even if we were, we're not. Do we? We're not alone.
Well, I mean, it's at least God. Right. I don't think we know.
I don't think he put all his faith in us. I think he might have gone to another neighborhood and say, okay, let's try that one too. See who wins out.
Yes.
When you had your comparisons, comparing the theory of nothing with the theory of everything, there's a little bit of a play on words, because it's not exactly the same theory of everything. It's just trying to relate all our knowledge into a unified equation, or, you know, electromagnetics and gravitation and quantum physics. Theory of nothing means, well, but was there anything before the particle that started the Big Bang? Or it had to have been something, but, you know, as Christians, we believe God was before the universe. It's not quite a
parallel.
It's not quite a parallel analogy. It was, you know,
yeah.
What I mean.
Yeah. The point I was trying to make is that in the Bible, in Genesis 1, we, creation, is out of nothing. And when
yeah.
I say out of nothing, it means
yeah.
nothing,
yeah.
not anything. In the theory of everything, the assumption, the leading candidate for that is the string theory or membrane theory or theory. That there was a quantum effect. There was something there. There's always something in nothing.
Oh.
In science, in quantum physics. There's
okay.
always, there's never a void, there's never a vacuum. Even
okay.
within a vacuum, there is
so
something.
So I didn't quite understand
that was the
concept there, because I was thinking more of Einstein, you know, the when we came up with general relativity and things, there was inconsistency between. Well, I don't understand it all, but you know what I mean? We don't really have a unified theory that explains gravity and electromagnetics in the same
exactly.
Equation.
No, we don't.
And that's usually called a unified theory. I
right.
mean, from
yes.
from my background.
Mm-hmm.
And so
yeah.
I didn't relate it to string theory
gravity
and that,
or,
other,
yeah.
that other thing. But so that it's more of a, when you talk about... that idea that there's parallel universes or string theory, or there must have been something before the Big Bang, that's more of a parallel analogy with
yeah. That was my intent.
That kind of makes sense there, but I didn't.
Yeah,
that
was my intent. That there's always something in nothing.
Right.
In quantum theory.
Right. I mean, you've probably heard it before. The I don't know, theory of, maybe I'm confusing the theory of everything with the. The quest for a unified equation. You got it.
That one I don't know.
Are there any other questions? Anyone?
Yes.
So I think you have certainly raised a great number of great questions. I wonder what you think about the limitations of human capacity to understand.
Well, yeah, I mean, what are we using, 5 or 6% of our brain power or something to that effect? You know, I think philosophically and scientifically, you know, that's a valid question. I think AI, I mean, can you imagine you're talking to your Siri, what time is it? You know, Siri, tell me what cosmology means. In the future, you'll have an AI implant, you'll just think about it. Mm-hmm. How far will AI go to answer your question? Will it become so universal and so far advanced that understanding will be there? I remember an Outer Limits program I saw many, many years ago. Remember Outer Limits?
Yeah. Yeah.
And this guy got in the time machine, and he came out 100 years later, and it was slightly different. He went back and came out 10,000 years later, and it was clear that his head was getting larger and larger and larger because the brain capacity was not being used. It needed more space, even though that scientifically may not be capable. But that the idea of the movie was, and then he went out a million and a billion and a trillion years, and he opened up the door, and the only thing that was left was consciousness.
Was what?
Consciousness. We had evolved into pure consciousness. Consciousness is what permeates the universe. That's just a sidebar.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
In terms of technology, you're talking about the new technology that's coming out, has anything been gleaned from data we're getting from Voyager with now how far out it's gone? Does that play into anything that they're learning now, or is that just irrelevant data?
I'm not familiar with what kind of data is coming back from Voyager. Are you?
They get
signals periodically, and there's very little actual. From what I understand, I mean they're getting pings basically every now and then. It's not really collecting much. Yeah, I mean it's basically left the solar system, but it's kind of in empty space at this point before it reaches the Oort cloud. But yeah, I mean it's actually I haven't checked on it recently, so I don't even know if it's still technically alive, but up until a few years ago anyway, they were still being able to ping it and get contact.
Well, that's it, but we're not getting anything from it.
Yeah.
You got the famous picture of the blue dot Earth or something.
Yeah, that's I think so, but that's been quite a while ago now too, right. Yeah.
Well, thank you for your patience and for putting up with this. I'm sorry that we didn't have the screen, but the power supply in there just could not be fixed. So I know this tested your eyesight and for the most part, but I sure appreciate your patience and listening, and thank you for the insight.
Absolutely. And let's thank him one more time. And feel free to stick around for a while. There's still snacks left, and we can have some more casual conversation. But thanks.